Thank you for being here. I wanted to show you, give you a little bit of background about my home state of Louisiana. I'm from North Louisiana. Those little yellow dots, those are oil wells. So this is the burden that we live with. This is what oil extraction off your coast looks like. That's about 3,359 active platforms, and then there's many more platforms that have been abandoned. So we have a tremendous footprint in Louisiana, one of the reasons we put up with this is that the oil industry and related jobs, support services, is about 320,000 jobs for coastal Louisiana. And in fact, we used to have a shrimp festival in the turn of the century. It would basically be when the boats go out, the start of shrimp season, you bless the boats and they go out and pull in a lot of harvest. In the 60s, they combined it with shrimp and petroleum festival. And most people don't think these get along, and for a while they did, but in 2010, that really changed. And there's a lot of give and take, I think, between the seafood industry and petroleum industry, more giving on the seafood industry and more taking on the petroleum industry. But I should warn you, I am an activist. One of the reasons that there's this conflict between these two industries is navigation canals. So if you see this right here, that is an oil and gas canal. So what you need to do is dredge out a piece of the wetland to get into this area where there's nice natural gas and petroleum. And what that does is allow salt water to come in, and it kills wetland plants. And so this turns into this. And that happens very, very quickly. This is a map of Louisiana and what most people think of as Louisiana. This is what you see in the United States, and we have that nice little boot. But we've lost 90% of our coastal wetlands. That's what it looked like in 1993, and this is our projection for the year 2020. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but coastal scientists blame those oil and gas canals for about 40 to 60% of it. So oil extraction is very dangerous. For a lot of reasons. For one, we are losing coastal Louisiana, but it also had an acute danger here. So 11 people lost their lives fairly instantly. And it's only getting more dangerous. The easy oil has been gotten. Like, the reason they're in deep water is because that's where the oil is now. And it's only more and more difficult and technologically challenging to get that oil. So when that happened, the Gulf Restoration Network went into overwork mode. So we were separated out into different pieces, trying to protect the environment, trying to get information was our number one challenge, I would say. And then getting that information out to our membership and communities. So the first thing that we learned was that the Mineral Management Service, which is the agency that is responsible for selling leases to oil companies, so that's their revenue generating arm, and it makes a lot of money. The same agency is also responsible for regulating those wells and overseeing those wells to make sure that they're operating properly. This is a terrible conflict of mission, and the one piece that they focused on was revenue generating, and the piece that they left off was the regulatory. In fact, we found out that many inspection reports were written by the oil engineers themselves on the gas well in pencil, and then the regulator would write over it in pen. This is actually seen. The regulators were also in trouble for quite outrageous behavior. I won't go into it, but let's just say women and illicit substances were involved, and free tickets to LSU games. I mean, this well was not required to do what's called a worst-case scenario plan. They basically had no disaster plan, even though it was, as Carrie said, a statistically likely event. BP has one of the worst safety records in the country. And so what they did was basically copy and pasted an environmental risk assessment, which included what kinds of animals might be impacted. And one of the things that they listed in the Gulf was walruses would be an impacted species. We don't have walruses, but what we do now have are t-shirts that say Save the Gulf Walrus. So I just wanted to go through the policy, what we were faced with when trying to pull information. So we had overlapping jurisdictions, legal frameworks, and then we all knew that there was going to be some major litigation. The Oil Pollution Act of 1990 was established after the Exxon Valdez spill to try to deal with what happens when there's a spill of national significance, which is definitely qualified. And what it does is it sets up jurisdiction. So it immediately puts the Coast Guard in charge of a marine spill. And the Coast Guard then charges BP, or the what's called the responsible party, and they have to pay for everything. So what they did with the Gulf oil disasters, the Coast Guard and BP set up these unified command centers, and these were just walled in places where you just couldn't get any information out of. BP was very secretive. They were trying to protect the bottom line, I suppose. They were also trying to cap the well, which was technologically very difficult, and the Coast Guard had no real expertise in the area. It was definitely a challenge. OSHA was a struggle. They were asked to provide masks for oil spill cleanup response workers, and they said that I was on a phone with them when they said it would do more harm than good, that it was just too hot. A lot of the oil response workers were fishermen. They were using their own boats in this program called Vessels of Opportunity. And these guys are on the water in the summer every year, so it's not like they're not used to the heat. The fumes were incredible out there, so not requiring respiratory protection, I think, was a misstep. EPA was doing all that they could to respond. They allowed the use of dispersant, and we had a big problem with EPA trying to get the chemical constituents of what was in the correct site. There are 80,000, I think Miriam can help me with this, about 80,000 chemicals that are allowed to be used in the United States, and we have no idea what the chemical constituents of those chemicals are, because that's proprietary business information. So getting just the what is in this stuff, what is being released, 2 million gallons of Corexit released in the Gulf. If that had happened just by itself, that would have been a major chemical spill. But that was released on purpose to counteract the oil. And I heard one person tell me recently, they said that the use of Corexit was a pretty big unknown, that they were trying to, that had a challenge. So the oil either stays in the marine environment or it comes on shore. And we know how hard it is to get oil off of wetlands. We don't know what that impact will be in the marine environment. So they basically chose an unknown over a known. And we're still kind of measuring the impacts of that. The FDA set up consumption rates to recommend how much seafood would be safe to eat, and we had a really hard time getting them to explain how they came up with a lot of their information. They finally did, but each of these federal organizations, and I'll go on to talk more a little bit about each of these with pictures, but some of them are used to working with the public and some of them aren't. So EPA is pretty, like working with the public is pretty routine. The FDA and the Coast Guard are really not used to being questioned. They're not used to interfacing with the public, and it was very awkward. There's a huge learning curve in those agencies, and I think still that'll continue. The five Gulf states, Texas all the way to Florida, were impacted by the spill, and then you had governors making deals and building sandcastles with BP money that made no impact, and all kinds of other things. The National Contingency Plan is just one more thing I want to touch on, which pre-approves the use of dispersant. Many of these, actually at the time, none of the dispersants had any long-term health studies done on them. So dealing with the response, you have pretty much three things to do, which is the exact same technology that's been used for 30 years. So what they did in Exxon Valdez, booming, burning, and dispersant. So these are the technologies that we have. There have been no improvements. If you see this right here, this is boom, and that is supposed to keep the oil on the outside. Oops. But as you can see, a boom really only works in 3-foot waves or lower. Otherwise, the oil just kind of hops right over and then it gets in the wetlands. This is what it looks like when you scoop the oil together. It becomes chocolate mousse. That's what it looks like up close. These have incredible fumes, and if you notice, no air mask or protective equipment. This is what it looks like in the wave action. And so that's why a lot of beaches had warnings. They weren't, all the beaches across the Gulf Coast were not closed. They were just put up warnings about what could be in the water. Recently, we've started seeing a lot of redfish become ill, and so it's raising more questions about seafood safety and what Carrie mentioned and Shannon about kind of this ethical dilemma about what to do. NOAA is the federal agency responsible for closing and opening fishing grounds. If there was any visible oil, they're supposed to close the fishing grounds. Reopening them meant that there had to be a certain amount of time without any visible oil. But once NOAA opened the fishing grounds, fishermen then, if they decided that they didn't actually trust the fish in the fishing grounds, they had no claim then to BP for lost wages. Once the fishing grounds are open, that means the seafood is safe. Ergo, you have no recourse if you don't agree with that. This is a lesion. This is becoming, this is really something that developed over the summer, and people are still researching it. This is what absorbent boom looks like in the wetland. And trying to clean this stuff up is really, really challenging. Sometimes you can do more damage to the wetland than good. And it generates a lot of trash. So one of the questions we were trying to nail down was, where is all this garbage going? Where's all these oily tar balls, everything? And the answer was it was coming on shore into these waste staging areas and then shipped off to municipal landfills. One mayor in Mississippi said, it's like my neighbor came over and dumped a bunch of trash in my front yard and then said, oh, I'm sorry, I cleaned it up and then dumped it in my backyard. We questioned whether or not this stuff should be going into municipal landfills, especially along Gulf Coast areas where the water table is very, very high, so only about 2 feet below ground. It's very wet, and we flood a lot, so we didn't want oily waste and debris going into a landfill that could then potentially flood and re-oil everything. But we were explained to us by the EPA that this oil is not hazardous. That confused a lot of people. The hazardous is a label, it's a technical label. It means that it's not going to catch on fire at 140 degrees. It's not going to leach into groundwater. And a couple of other technical things. But when the EPA goes around and tells communities, the oil's not hazardous, that did not sit well. So it was taking communities to waste staging areas and explaining the process and kind of how that went. And honestly, we didn't have a better recommendation on what to do with the garbage. But that's basically where it went. We supported independent monitoring, went out on planes and boats, site visits to waste staging areas, and groups across the Gulf are doing their independent water, fish, and soil sampling, just to make sure that results are verified. So we have a saying, I actually learned this from Lisa Jackson, trust but verify. dispersants were not popular. Again, like, we just had no idea what was in them. We did, with Earth Justice, sue the EPA and got the constituent amounts, but it took a lawsuit and several months of negotiations to get that information. And that's what dispersed oil looks like under the water. And fishermen really hated it. Like, the oil was one thing, but the dispersant was this very scary thing that nobody knew anything about or what the long-term impacts were going to be. Controlled burning. So this is what we were told, was this is actually the best way to get the oil out of the water. But the air quality was horrible. And thankfully, the Louisiana Bucket Brigade was successful in getting air monitoring stations put up along the coast. But again, no respiratory equipment was required for oil spill workers. I put this in more, wildlife has more legal protection than human beings, just because since dealing with the oil disaster, there have been a lot of task forces on how to restore the ecosystem, but there have been no task forces on the public health, even though that has been asked for repeatedly. And though we have a long-term health worker study, which I think is fantastic, since it's only the second or third long-term worker health study on oil spills ever done, even though there's been thousands of oil spills, there have been no place for people who are sick to go to talk to government officials except for these ecosystem places. So the public health has been taking over the conversation on ecosystem restoration, and it's just been very, very challenging. Ken Feinberg said there had been no health claims, which is inaccurate. And in fact, I know a fisherman in Florida who I swore I would never reveal who, but he actually got a health claim, and then he was required to sign a lot of confidentiality agreements about that claim. We've had to litigate a lot, or Gulf Restoration had to litigate a lot just to get information, and FOIA requests, breaking down these barriers, working with agencies who aren't used to public input, and many other ways to get information, developing special relationships with people on the inside, that kind of thing. These are the recommendations from this experience that if this happens again, and also parts to try to prevent this from ever happening again. So. Engaging and empowering impacted citizens. One of the benefits that we had from Hurricane Katrina was a lot of cross-discipline relationships had been developed between social justice, environment, and public health folks. And those relationships were very useful in responding to this disaster. Testifying in front of Congress, the Senate, and working with the Obama administration helped a lot. It helped get a lot of information to the Gulf Coast that otherwise we wouldn't have gotten. The Gulf Coast Restoration Plan, there are these large restoration plans that enabled citizens to engage in the process. That could have been much better, but again, at least there was some engagement with citizens and nonprofit groups. There really needs to be a regional citizen advisory council in the Gulf for citizens in order to give them more power over what's happening out there. After Exxon Valdez, they got a citizen advisory council, and the citizens actually are very actively engaged in dealing with the oil industry there. And regulatory changes, I would suggest running the EPA a little bit more like the FDA, even though the FDA is not perfect, I'm not saying that. But these unknown chemicals, and the reason I say that, Miriam's giving me a face, the way medication becomes to market is you have to prove that it's effective, you have to prove that it's safe, relatively, like it's not a perfect system, but chemicals do have no process for proving that they're safe before they go into market. And I would highly recommend that change, especially for dispersants. And then the MMS, we call it the Mineral Mismanagement Service, was broken up, and it's now into three different agencies, and so that revenue generating piece has been removed from the regulatory piece, which I hope will solve a lot of those inherent problems. So thank you so much.